Chapter 4, The Reins of Power. Follow me, clan motto of the Campbells of Breadalbin.
We have already entered that phase of history where experience provides in part only our future course. Alex Campbell, Provincial Television Address, September 1966.
Alex Campbell did not have long to wait to be introduced to the issues that he would face as premier. Following the late-night celebrations that accompanied the by-election victory in Surrey on the evening of July 11th, Campbell and his wife Marilyn were too tired to drive home to Summerside. They stayed at the Charlottetown Hotel, arriving at 4 a.m. 3 hours later, they were awakened by a phone call from Reverend Malcolm McCaig, who was serving as mediator in high-tension labor negotiations at the local Canada Packers plant. McCaig asked to meet the premier-elect in the hotel lobby to brief him on the situation. While in the lobby, Campbell encountered Hartwell Daly, a political columnist and commentator who served as part-time economic advisor to the Shaw government. Daly told Campbell about a series of research studies aimed at laying the foundation for a federal-provincial economic development plan. Premier Shaw had spoken of an ambitious economic plan during the election campaign, but had offered few details. While Daly also offered few details, he told Campbell that the plan was ready to launch. As events would unfold, almost 3 years of arduous planning and negotiation would be required before an economic agreement was consummated. Campbell's first day was a busy one. By nightfall on July 12th, he would have a 25-minute meeting with Prime Minister Lester Pearson, whose plane made a brief stopover en route from Newfoundland to Ottawa. Alex and Marilyn Campbell led a delegation that included Mayor George Key to meet the Prime Minister's party at CFB Summerside. Pearson announced early on that he couldn't stay long, offering as a reason, "We are in a hurry to get back as we are putting through Medicare tonight." After congratulating Campbell and holding a brief discussion, Pearson departed at 7:22 p.m. with a bag of lobsters. He left behind Federal Public Works Minister George McElraith, who stayed on to take part in a 2-day briefing on the Northumberland Strait Causeway. Both outgoing Premier Shaw and Premier-elect Campbell attended the Causeway briefing. The multitasking Hartwell Daly was also there, writing in the journal Pioneer, "The figures rolled out so fast that it was impossible to take them down." Daly was no less optimistic about the causeway than he was about the putative development plan, concluding, "Anyone who attended any part of the 2-day briefing knows that the causeway will be built and that it is being built." On July 7th, only 4 days before the deferred election, a $1.4 million contract to construct a causeway approach road had been awarded, with work to start by mid-August. As it turns out, it would be more than 30 years before a fixed-link crossing between Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick was completed. Thus, within less than 48 hours of becoming premier-elect, Alex Campbell had a brush with three of the most consequential public policy issues of his mandate: the causeway, Medicare, and the Comprehensive Development Plan. For good measure, before he was sworn in as premier, Campbell would be introduced to a fourth significant and ultimately thorny policy file. On July 25th, Federal Minister of Northern Affairs and Natural Resources Arthur Lang toured the beach areas of the province by helicopter, accompanied by Alex Campbell, to eye up potential sites for a second national park with particular interest in eastern Kings County. Following the tour, Lang pronounced that Prince Edward Island had the best beaches in North America, and if the province wants a second park, we will see that it is built.
Building the governing team.
In addition to the high-flying enticements of national parks, causeways, development plans, and Medicare, Alex Campbell had a number of down-to-earth issues to deal with as he prepared to take the reins of government, starting with naming a cabinet. Considering that he had only 17 MLAs, Campbell had an impressive selection of talent to consider. Rather than be governed by the time-honored cabinet-making principle of geographic representation, Campbell chose 6 of his original 9 cabinet ministers from 3 electoral districts. Moreover, 4 of the 9 were from the least populous Kings County. Obviously, geography did not rule the day. Campbell did his best to align the talents of his team with their respective portfolios. Lorne Bunnell was asked his preference. He chose tourism development and welfare. Chartered accountant T. Earl Hickey was the obvious choice to be provincial treasurer, and longtime educator Gordon Bennett was a good fit in education. Dan MacDonald was a natural for agriculture, and the capable and judicious George Ferguson was given the politically sensitive highways and public works portfolio. Keir Clark's previous cabinet experience and business skills were handy in health and municipal affairs. Lawyer Elmer Blanchard was named Minister of Labor, an area where a significant amount of law reform was anticipated. Cecil Miller was given a heavy load as Minister of Fisheries and Minister of Industry and Natural Resources, perhaps recognizing that Miller's feisty nature would be handy in skirmishing with former ministers of the Shaw government over the Georgetown file. Campbell himself took the job of Attorney General, in addition to Premier and unofficial Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs. Gordon Bennett took the formal title of President of Executive Council. Robert Campbell was indicated as Minister without Portfolio, sometimes to be taunted by the opposition as Minister without Employment, but was not sworn in until the fall session of the legislature approved an expansion of cabinet to 10 members from 9. Soft-spoken Prosper Arsenault would later be selected as Speaker of the Legislative Assembly. Of equal importance to assembling the cabinet was establishing a team in the Premier's office. Campbell knew that he needed someone close to him with the combined skills of a writer, traffic cop, critical thinker, and confidant. For this he turned to Andy Wells, whom he had known since 1961 when Wells came to him for advice in a legal dispute with a Summerside car dealer. Wells, who was slightly younger than Campbell, was running the family farm and teaching in Alberton. He helped out when Campbell sought the federal nomination in 1963 and in subsequent campaigns. Wells and Campbell developed a political and intellectual yin-yang, which Campbell would describe as follows in a 1987 interview. "Let's say we got into each other's heads. He was a great writer, and I was a very poor writer. I could rattle off a few ideas of what I wanted to say in a meeting, and Andy could get it down somehow on paper." Wells became private secretary to Campbell, writing speeches, offering ideas, and being the conduit for people seeking access to the Premier. Wells recalls modestly, "It was easy flow. I just flowed into the office. I was there, and I was doing stuff for Alex." In recognition of the importance of relations with the federal government, and with no Liberal MPs from PEI, Campbell had John Mullally take the title Federal Provincial Coordinator. Mullally says that it wasn't long before Campbell could find his own way around in Ottawa. A team of efficient and tactful secretaries made up the front line and the backbone of the Premier's office. Sherry Findlay, who was Andy Wells' aunt, served as Campbell's secretary throughout his years as Premier. Muriel Deakin joined Findlay in managing a high volume of correspondence and paper, plus a steady stream of visitors, meetings, and appointments. Aletha Creed assisted with the transition. At later stages, Deakin was succeeded by Joyce McCollum and later by Anne Smith. Wayne McKinnon joined the office in 1968 as private secretary when Andy Wells took the title executive assistant. McKinnon recalls, "We tried to keep a fairly open office and for people to feel that they were listened to. That's what Alex wanted." There was no shake-up of deputy ministers from the Shaw administration. Some Liberals wanted Campbell to get rid of people with conservative political attachments, such as Lauren Monckley, who had preceded Campbell as MLA for Fifth Prince and had been appointed deputy provincial secretary following his defeat as a federal conservative candidate in 1963. However, Campbell took the view that Monckley should remain if he was competent to do the job. That is not to say that the Campbell government was free from patronage. It was no coincidence that Ned Beliveau's firm, Tandy Advertising, replaced Dalton Camp in providing tourism marketing services to the province.
First days in office.
The Shaw administration took its time handing over the reins. Campbell and his cabinet were not sworn in until July 28th. In the uncommonly long 17 days between the election and the handover of power, the outgoing cabinet made a number of decisions that went beyond the conventions for transitional governments. These included awarding contracts that would tie up most of the 1966-67 highways budget and deciding on the second last day in office to name the newly constructed government complex on Rochford Street the Walter R. Shaw Building. The Campbell government rescinded the highways contracts and declared that the Shaw Building would be known as the Provincial Administrative Building. The latter decision was criticized by some as showing bad grace toward the former premier, even though it was generally conceded that it was problematic for a transitional government to name the office complex in honor of its defeated leader. In the main, there was an underlying camaraderie in the relationship between Campbell and Shaw. While the former premier led the opposition with vigor and characteristic bluster, Campbell credits Shaw with teaching him important lessons about separating the personal from the political, recalling that the opposition leader could become enraged and even outrageous in his condemnation of the government on the floor of the House. He'd be angry, shaking his fist and red in the face, lathering the government hell west and crooked, But when the bell rang, we'd all go out in the hall, and Mr. Shaw would come along behind me and slap me on the back and say, "Well, Alec, don't take it personally." Then he would laugh and guffaw. The spirit of cooperation went beyond backslapping. For example, Campbell invited Shaw to join the PEI delegation at a federal-provincial conference to assist in making the argument for the causeway and to represent the province at Commonwealth meetings in Uganda. Once in office, Campbell quickly became immersed in the multitude of details of governing the province, starting with the challenging financial situation. The audit firm Touche, Ross, Bailey & Smart conducted an external review and reported that Prince Edward Island's net debt would reach $61 million by the end of the 1966-67 fiscal year, making it the most indebted province in Canada on a per capita basis. More than one-third of the accumulated debt appeared on the province's books in 3 years between March 1964 and March 1967. This included an increase of $5.5 million between March 31st and July 28, 1966. To make matters worse, a large portion of Prince Edward Island's debt was in short-term debentures, and financial markets were cool to the province's initiatives to borrow long-term. In late September 1966, Campbell spoke in a province-wide television address about his first 2 months in office. He emphasized the province's financial challenges and said, "We are sparing no effort to place the administration of government on a sound financial basis so that we may continue with the implementation of our policies." As Campbell came to power, Canada's federal and provincial governments were hammering out the architecture of fiscal federalism as the post-war surge of government programs and spending reached its peak. The points under discussion included details of shared cost programs, parameters for the use of the federal spending power, terms and formulas for equalization and other transfers, and the respective taxing capacities and jurisdictions of federal and provincial governments. When Campbell and Finance Minister Earl Hickey attended a federal-provincial tax structure meeting in Ottawa in mid-September of 1966, they were deeply disappointed when federal officials unveiled revised equalization transfers that would see Prince Edward Island receive an additional $200,000 annually. This compared with $57 million in combined increases for the other three Atlantic provinces. Alex Campbell commented wryly that the increase proposed for PEI was equal to the province's annual skunk bounty. By the time the Tax Structure Committee met again in late October, the proposed Prince Edward Island transfers had increased substantially, going from $11 million in 1966 to $14 million in 1967, with Prince Edward Island continuing to receive the highest transfers of any province on a per capita basis. The Tax Structure Committee was typical of numerous such tables that were active during Alex Campbell's years in office. Federal and provincial leaders and officials met regularly to deal with Medicare, manpower and training programs, pensions, housing, transportation, agriculture, law reform, and an array of other issues. Campbell's first out-of-province meeting after his election was the annual early August gathering of Canadian premiers. In 1966, they met in Toronto, and the main topic was provincial concern about the terms the federal government was proposing for a national Medicare program. Campbell and his wife Marilyn would look forward to the annual get-togethers of premiers as an opportunity to build relationships and to compare notes with the provincial counterparts. These were also rare vacations. The premiers' meetings generally fell near the Campbells' August 19th wedding anniversary. This was also an active time in national politics for both Liberals and Conservatives. In early October of 1966, Campbell and a lively delegation of Prince Edward Island Liberals traveled to a National Party conference in Ottawa. Campbell stole the show with his surprise motion of confidence in Prime Minister Lester Pearson, which was unanimously adopted on the opening evening of the conference. He was subsequently criticized by the Charlottetown Guardian for being thankful overmuch, given the snubs this province has received from Ottawa in recent months. While in Ottawa for the conference, Campbell had private meetings with Prime Minister Pearson, Finance Minister Mitchell Sharp, Agriculture Minister Joe Green, Rural Development Minister Maurice Sauvé, Defence Minister Paul Hellyer, Fisheries Minister Adair Robichaud, Public Works Minister George McElraith, and Transport Minister Jack Pickersgill. Correspondence between Campbell and federal ministers, including Pearson and Finance Minister Mitchell Sharp, as well as cabinet discussions over subsequent weeks, show that the early October meetings laid the foundation for a substantially better deal for Prince Edward Island under the revised equalization formula. On the home legislative front, the pace was frenetic. In 1968, Alex Campbell commented cryptically, "We walk a precarious political tightrope while in office here." With 16 MLAs on the government side of the legislature facing 15 on the opposition benches, every day was a political tightrope. Walter Shaw led the opposition with vigor, not letting Campbell forget the closing words of Shaw's 1966 concession speech. "I shall not attempt to force another election unless the government makes a very serious mistake, and I would not expect Mr. Campbell to make any mistakes in the years ahead." The opposition kept the government on its toes, with Shaw describing the 1967 speech from the throne as a linguistic extravaganza, and terming the session as a whole as barren of accomplishment. In contrast, Premier Campbell described the session as more productive than any other in the history of the island legislature. The 1967 session was the second longest ever on Prince Edward Island, adopting 78 new laws. These included lowering the voting age to 18, requiring annual paid vacations for all employees, establishing the Economic Improvement Corporation, and raising legislative salaries. The combined salary and expenses for MLAs was increased to $4,000, and the Premier's salary to $13,000. Notwithstanding the tight purse strings and the slim margin in the legislature, policymaking and institution building were approached with a can-do spirit and optimism rarely seen in PEI politics. This was typified by Minister of Labour Elmer Blanchard, who told the legislature that Prince Edward Island had the opportunity to become a model for the rest of North America in the field of labour-management relations. The 1968 legislative session was similarly productive, with 70 new bills receiving royal assent. These included a new Human Rights Act, as well as legislation dealing with planning, municipalities, mental health, liquor control, jails, and reform of the Chancery Court. The biggest surprise of the 1968 session came when Alex Campbell, in his role as Attorney General, introduced the Lord's Day Act. This was a bill intended to clarify or open up activities permitted on Sunday, such as movies, sports, or theatrical performances. The legislation was based on the recommendations of an 8-person citizens committee. When the bill came to second reading, the opposition was doing its job of finding holes and ambiguities, questioning the makeup of the committee, and poring over hypotheticals about what was permitted, such as golf, or not, such as horse races or public dances, when it became apparent that Minister Without Portfolio Robert Campbell was thinking about voting against the bill. The Lord's Day Act was summarily dropped from the order paper as the government was reminded of the precariousness of the political rope on which they teetered.
Georgetown Industries, a crash course in economic development.
The most heated and regular debates during the first years of Campbell's government concerned what became referred to simply as Georgetown. Gulf Garden Foods had been set up in the port of Georgetown to process frozen fish and PEI agricultural produce, while Bathurst Marine would build trawlers to harvest the fish. Jens Moe was a 36-year-old unscrupulous promoter and a Montrealer of Norwegian extraction. Moe obtained a $750,000 loan from the Shaw government in the fall of 1963. By 1965, the investments were significantly greater, but the facts were murky. As an opposition MLA, Alex Campbell questioned the Shaw government about its dealings with Moe. In the dying days of the 1966 legislative session, Campbell called for a judicial investigation and external audit of the Industrial Development Corporation and the Fisherman's Loan Board. This was dismissed by Premier Shaw and his Minister of Fisheries and Industry, Leo Rossiter, as being against industry. When Premier Shaw announced the 1966 election in an April 16th television address, he pointed to Liberal questions about the Georgetown investments as a primary reason for calling the vote, saying, "I am convinced our people will wish to stamp out this unfortunate and vicious propaganda and protect the interests of the province at large." Within Campbell's first few weeks in office, the possible magnitude of the Georgetown problems began to emerge, notably through calls to the Premier's office from frustrated creditors and previously unknown investors. By late September 1966, government was providing funds to cover the payroll. On November 30th, Gulf Garden Foods ceased operation, and by March 1967, both companies had been placed in bankruptcy. Shortly before the legislature opened in March 1967, Premier Campbell announced the appointment of a royal commission to look into the history of the Georgetown companies and their financial dealings with government. The commission was chaired by Judge C. St. Clair Traynor, joined by Commissioners Ian McKeegan, a Nova Scotia lawyer who was also chairman of the Atlantic Development Board, and Montreal accountant Alexander Pierce. The Conservative opposition went to considerable ends to frustrate and challenge the work of the Royal Commission, beginning with a motion on the second day of the legislative session calling for an emergency debate on Georgetown. The motion was ruled out of order by the Speaker on the grounds that the closed plants did not constitute an emergency. After the legislature closed, former Premier Shaw went to court to challenge the legality of the commission, first before the Prince Edward Island Supreme Court, and then on appeal to the full Supreme Court. Shaw argued that only the legislature could question the performance and conduct of government officials and public servants. After the challenges were dismissed at trial and on appeal, the commission commenced hearings in February 1968. The court challenges did gain one concession for the former government when the appeal decision of the full Supreme Court added the recommendation that the commission should encourage and permit, but not compel, present or former cabinet ministers to appear and testify before it. Premier Campbell was the only elected official to appear. Shaw and his former ministers declined the invitation. Jens Moe refused to come to Prince Edward Island, suggesting that the commission meet with him in Montreal, but the commission had no power to compel witnesses outside of PEI. In its July 1969 report, the commission concluded that Jens Moe was lacking in the necessary business expertise and knowledge for the venture. It also concluded that a primary contributing factor to the business failure was that Moe was paid more than $600,000 off the top. It found that Premier Shaw and his cabinet ministers failed to make proper investigations or follow the advice of senior officials, and that Industry Minister Leo Rossiter invariably supported Moe when there was a difference of opinion with officials and advisers. The Royal Commission found that the government's investments in the two companies totaled $9.9 million, while the residual value of the assets was $3.1 million. Creditors received only 20 cents on the dollar. The Georgetown Affair provided a rough introduction to economic development for Alex Campbell's government. The 1967 and 68 sessions of the legislature included much verbal volleying on the subject. The exchanges between former Minister Leo Rossiter and Liberal Industry Minister Cecil Miller were especially heated, resulting on one occasion in Rossiter being suspended by the Speaker for unparliamentary language. Verbal fisticuffs aside, the Georgetown fiasco provided the Prince Edward Island government with an expensive lesson in economic development. In the 1960s, governments in Atlantic Canada, tempted by federal industrial development grants, out-of-town promoters with grand schemes, and the urge to catch up with the booming economy of the rest of Canada, plunged into speculative enterprises that more often than not resulted in colossal failures. These included heavy water, televisions and stereos in Nova Scotia, an oil refinery and paperboard plant among other ventures in Newfoundland, and mines and manufacturing ventures in New Brunswick. By these standards, Prince Edward Island was a small player. But $9.9 million was a lot of money for the cash-strapped PEI government to invest. Moreover, the Georgetown fiasco took 5 years of time, attention, and resources from government, from both large and small players in the private sector, and from the Prince Edward Island public. In terms of opportunity cost, these financial resources, along with 5 years of valuable time and attention, could have been better directed to more productive and plausible endeavors.
The Comprehensive Development Plan.
Even before he became Premier, Alex Campbell realized that developing Prince Edward Island's economy would require a new deal with Ottawa. In preparation for debate on the Shaw government's 1966 budget, Campbell reviewed all of the revenue and expenditure columns and concluded, following conversations with business professor Joe Revel, that by the time you paid for education and the health system and other social benefits, there was no money left over. The province's only ability to encourage the development of our resources was by word of mouth. We needed to find new sources of revenues so that we could invest in the economic development of the province. From Campbell's perspective, the only conceivable new source of revenue would be the federal government. After coming to office, Campbell made it his business to build relationships in Ottawa. During this period, Atlantic Canada benefited from strong regional ministers in Alan McKechnie and Jack Pickersgill, who helped to make up for the fact that Prince Edward Island had no Liberal MPs. Campbell found a strong supporter in Public Works Minister George McIlraith, and formed a warm relationship with Maurice Sauvé, Minister of Forestry and Rural Development. An early highlight of Campbell's Ottawa interactions was an invitation to dine at home with Maurice and Jean Sauvé. Sauvé was responsible for the Fund for Rural Economic Development, or FRID, which was established in May 1966 as a cost-shared regional development program with broader and more flexible arrangements than were available under its predecessor. Campbell saw in the FRID program the potential for an economic blitzkrieg in slow-growth regions, commenting in an interview with the Financial Post, "For the first time in history, we are able to face problems of regional development with federal programs designed for the basic needs of the region, not piecemeal solutions." Campbell elsewhere described FRID as the key to breaking the traditional budget and handout approach. The FRID program provided funds to build economic development and planning capacity in the targeted provinces. With the reports from Acres Research coming in, the Campbell government opted to use these resources to go beyond reliance on consultants and to set up a separate unit called the Economic Improvement Corporation. The EIC, as it came to be known, was a Crown corporation reporting directly to Campbell. Del Gallagher, a brash young economist who had worked on development programs in New Brunswick, was named general manager of the EIC. He came well recommended by Premier Louis Robichaud and by Federal Director General of Rural Development Programs, Len Petsky. Petsky recalls that he told Alex Campbell about Gallagher, "He's a bugger, he's a renegade, but he knows what he's doing." With the FRID funds, Gallagher moved quickly to assemble a team of economists and planners. Almost all of them were, as Prince Edward Islanders would say, from away. He recruited internationally, including through ads in The Economist, and traveled as far as London to interview and hire people. The EIC set up temporary quarters on the ground floor of Province House. Diane Flood was the first employee hired by Gallagher as a 20-year-old secretary who had worked with H.G. Acres while they completed the PEI studies. Flood recalls the high level of activity at EIC and the rudimentary challenges of building an organization. This included having desks made by local tradespeople because it would take too long to order them in. According to Flood, Del Gallagher was a considerate and kind boss. He shared cigarettes with her. Everyone smoked at EIC. John Mullally was occasionally in contact with the EIC on behalf of Alex Campbell. He recalls that Gallagher was a regular user of the speakerphone, which was a relatively new thing at the time. Mullally says that with the high ceilings in Province House and Gallagher's booming voice, you'd think God was speaking. At its peak, the EIC built up a team of almost 200 employees, consisting mainly of economic and social planners and experts in land use planning and mapping. While there were frequent comments, led by the opposition in the legislature, about the accents or attitudes of the EIC experts, Gallagher and his team plowed ahead. Richard Higgins was a young economist from Australia. Asked 40 years later how his PEI experience rated in the context of a career working on significant public policy and development issues in Canada and abroad, Higgins had a simple response. Number one, the best experience of my career. We really did live through our own Camelot. As for comments about him being from away, Higgins recalled, "Islanders are such nice people that even when they are being rude to you, they're too nice for it to stick. So I just ignored it." In early April of 1967, Premier Campbell introduced to the legislature a 34-page white paper on economic planning and development, authored by Gallagher. The white paper had a simple argument, that per capita incomes on Prince Edward Island were the second lowest in Canada, and that a new comprehensive approach to economic development was required to close the gap. Previous economic development initiatives were said to have been aimed at isolated problems, and to have lacked in both breadth and depth the essential ingredients of a solution to the problem of faster and sustained rates of growth. The white paper called for a more precise application of government responsibility for economic development and enunciated five principles. That economic development must be comprehensive, encompassing all sectors of the PEI economy. That it must be of substantial magnitude, capable of reducing the income gap relative to the national average to as near zero as is humanly possible. That it must be dynamic, reducing the rate of out-migration and increasing opportunities on Prince Edward Island, with income growth being built into the economy as a permanent feature. That the economic development plan should include the quantity and quality of government services. And finally, that a development plan must be for the people and involving the people. Premier Campbell concluded his presentation to the legislature with the following words.
In the course of its long history, our island province has experienced many things. It has been raided and annexed. It has seen massive deportation, surrender to the British, and confederation with Canada. It will soon see the long-awaited construction of a causeway to the mainland. But the island has never experienced the impact of a major and comprehensive development program. This program, from the federal perspective, may well constitute its finest and most significant centennial gesture. From the provincial side, in committing itself to such a course of action, the government is fully conscious of the fact that a development plan itself will not ensure that the challenges will be met, that the problems will be solved, or that success will be achieved. Such assurance can only arise out of individual understanding of the needs, acceptance of responsibility for action, and full participation in the program to come. In formulating objectives and preparing a plan, we have only begun to move into the new future for Prince Edward Island. The plan is, then, to paraphrase Sir Winston Churchill, not the end, neither is it the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning.
While anticipating the need for further analysis and the completion of the Acres research studies, the white paper projected a list of strategies, the first of which was that the island economy must have as its basis massive development of the agricultural sector. It called for diversification of industry to include manufacturing related to the province's resource base plus expansion of tourism. It said that there should be rationalization in the primary sectors, including modern technologies, managerial techniques, and increased labor force productivity. Underlying these strategies was a conviction that new approaches to education and training must be an essential component of Prince Edward Island's economic development. The white paper acknowledged the role of government to identify priorities, to prepare a plan, and to provide sustained leadership along with encouragement and assistance to those in the process of adjusting to a changing economic environment. The 1967 white paper was not the first opportunity for islanders to hear about the need for an economic development plan. In his September 1966 televised address, Campbell told islanders, "The results of fiscal arrangements between our province and the federal government will dictate the extent to which we can embark upon new and comprehensive social and economic development of our resources." In late January 1967, with the government still less than 6 months in office, Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald was guest speaker at the annual meeting of the PEI Aberdeen Angus Breeders Association. He told his audience that the province hoped to have an agreement signed with the federal government by the end of May for a comprehensive development plan designed to bring about a rapid and sustained improvement in the economic and social status of the province. MacDonald's speech was most likely prepared by Andy Wells, with input from Del Gallagher, who had only been on the ground for a short time. From the earliest days of the Comprehensive Development Plan, it was clear that the Cabinet would play a prominent role in crafting, selling, and owning the plan. The leadership came from Premier Campbell, who, in the words of historian Wayne MacKinnon, used the full force of his personality and the prestige of his office to sustain the planning process. Campbell says that 7 of his 10 Cabinet ministers were eagerly engaged in the planning process, starting with how it would benefit their portfolios. The 3 who were less than eagerly engaged were Lorne Bunnell, Robert Campbell, and Keir Clark, who was philosophically opposed. Del Gallagher and his federal counterpart Hector Horty did not have such a favorable view as Campbell did of Cabinet's role. Horty commented in a 1972 interview, "I had a feeling that, on the whole, the Cabinet did not understand the planning process. I think that a number of members did not want to understand it, and had already made up their minds that they did not want to see the changes taking place." With this dissonance, whether real or perceived, between the planners and some members of Cabinet, Alex Campbell served as both shepherd and spear carrier for the plan. EIC officials spent a lot of time in front of Cabinet. In early August 1968, Cabinet met 7 times in 11 days to receive sector-by-sector briefings. The meetings lasted from 3 to 5 hours, with the ultimate session starting at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday. Cabinet endorsed the final strategy and push in negotiations with the federal government. Early predictions that an agreement would be concluded by mid-1967 were wildly premature. It would be March of 1969 before the Comprehensive Development Plan was finalized, after much hard work and negotiation, accompanied by disappointment and strained patience. Del Gallagher and his team moved with a bravado to which islanders were unaccustomed, which in itself provided ammunition to the plan skeptics. The Conservatives complained that details were not disclosed, that islanders had not been consulted, that there were too many experts involved, that too many of them were from away, that Prince Edward Island was not getting a good enough financial deal, and ultimately that the province was surrendering its sovereignty. In May of 1969, after Keir Clark laid out his reasons for resigning from Cabinet in opposition to the plan, an editorial in the Evening Patriot said that his speech represented
a collision between the contemporary and the traditional, between the swingers and the waltzers.
While the planned skeptics, or the waltzers, showed up predominantly in the news, the popular momentum was with the swingers. The Rural Development Council was attracting large numbers of people to community schools and to other public engagement activities. The labor movement was growing, as were attempts to organize farmers. The regional high schools offered students new opportunities to be involved, as did youth organizations. In 1968-69, the National Film Board made an extensive two-part documentary about the PEI development plan and the process, producing films entitled 10 Days in September and 4 Days in March. In December 1968, the CBC program The Public Eye devoted a broadcast to the PEI plan, with guest host Jen Sauvé interviewing Alex Campbell, Del Gallagher, land expert Charlie Raymond, as well as farmers, a processor, a fisherman, and tourists. Sauvé closed the broadcast with this insightful comment.
The real difficulty with planning is not just to produce a good plan, hard as that may be, but to persuade people to accept the plan. Del Gallagher thinks that the EIC plan can eventually eliminate the need for special federal aid to PEI. He thinks it will create more jobs than it eliminates and increase living standards. So does Premier Campbell. What is crucial is whether the people of PEI feel the same way. When you are poor, or underdeveloped, as we now say, people always seem to be doing things for you or to you, and you grow very wary and proud. The problem of the planners is to make the island pride work for them rather than against them.
From the first days of talking about the development plan, Alex Campbell and the planners stressed that it was to be of the people and for the people. At the March 1969 signing ceremony, this was the focus of Campbell's brief remarks. The audience applauded when Campbell announced, "I would like to say, most emphatically, that this development plan is not a government plan. It is a plan by the people, of the people, and for the people." These comments notwithstanding, the fact that Islanders had heard about the plan for 2.5 years before the details were finally unveiled in March 1969 meant that Campbell was perceived for the duration of his time as Premier, even at the height of his popularity, as being more for planning than action. And that there was an indelible feeling, notwithstanding publicity campaigns, teach-ins, public meetings, and other initiatives, that the plan fell short when it came to public engagement.
Getting the CDP across the finish line.
It took from early 1967 to March 1969 to negotiate and finalize the PEI Comprehensive Development Plan. The primary reason for the length of time required was the plan's comprehensiveness, ranging across sectors of the economy and federal-provincial jurisdictional lines. One of Del Gallagher's favorite phrases was wide-ranging. When Alex Campbell was shown an advanced draft of the plan proposal, he crossed out every reference to wide-ranging. In addition to its scope, comprehensive development planning was a new endeavor for both levels of government. Federal Regional Development Director General Len Petschke wrote in 1968, "The present bureaucratic machinery was created in an era when the government role was largely administrative and hardly, if at all, developmental. Up to the present time, Canadian governments have been trying to adapt and use this machinery to carry out these new functions and in a socio-economic political environment that is vastly different than in the past. There were only 5 agreements concluded under the FRED program. The first 2, in the Northeast and Mactaquac regions of New Brunswick, were the least complex. The 3rd was in the Interlake region of Manitoba, and the 4th in the Gaspé region of Quebec. The Prince Edward Island Plan was the last of the series." A further reason for delay was PEI's decision to wait until the Gaspé Plan was finalized, based on Del Gallagher's calculation that Prince Edward Island would be in a better negotiating position if it could use the Quebec terms as a precedent. Len Petschke says that this delay was fatal, a big mistake. The Quebec Agreement was signed with much fanfare in May 1968 by Prime Minister Trudeau and Quebec Premier Daniel Johnson in the middle of a federal election campaign. André Saumier, who was Assistant Deputy Minister responsible for regional development programs, says that Gallagher was a picaresque negotiator. He says that Gallagher would periodically threaten to go over Saumier's head to the Department of Finance. Saumier was unimpressed, saying, That didn't have much of an impact on me, because we had the money. Finance was basically hostile to all that spending. Saumier recalls that one day Gallagher called me at my apartment in Ottawa at 6 a.m. to inform me that he was severing all contacts with our department and would be dealing with finance. I told him to go ahead. I think he was surprised. As of September 1968, CDP negotiations had practically broken down. The federal leadership changeover from the Pearson to Trudeau administrations added to the period required to finalize the plan and strained relations between PEI and Ottawa, not least because it changed most of the key federal players. From late 1967 to April 1968, Prime Minister Pearson was perceived to be a lame duck while the Liberals chose his successor. Pierre Trudeau's selection as leader was followed immediately by a federal election on June 25th, in which Rural Development Minister Maurice Sauvé was not re-elected. Sauvé had been forced through redistribution to find a new riding when his Magdalen Islands district was amalgamated with the Gaspé. Having initially supported Paul Martin Sr. in the Liberal leadership race, Sauvé was left by party power brokers to run unsuccessfully in Saint-Hyacinthe, a traditionally conservative riding south of Montreal. With Sauvé and Pearson off the scene, Ottawa brought a new outlook to regional development and to the FRED program. Jean Marchand replaced Sauvé as minister, with former Pearson aide Tom Kent as his deputy. Marchand and Kent had worked together as minister and deputy of manpower and immigration. They urged Prime Minister Trudeau to create a new super department of development, but he opted instead for the Department of Regional Economic Expansion, or DREE as it came to be known. Kent didn't consider this much of a challenge, writing in his memoir, "It would be hard to imagine a more mixed bag of relatively small units." Kent ran the department in close consultation with the Prime Minister's office, while Marchand focused mainly on his role as Quebec strongman. The changeover was seen with chagrin by senior federal officials who had been leading the FRED program and negotiating the Prince Edward Island plan. Len Petschke viewed it as disastrous, and André Saumier says the PEI plan was cannibalized by Tom Kent. Within months, both Petschke and Saumier were gone. Petschke moved to Nova Scotia as a senior regional development official, and Saumier became an economic advisor in Niger, to return to Ottawa a year later as Deputy Minister of Urban Affairs. Kent concedes in his memoir that the reorganization of the department was difficult, and that he earned some lifelong enemies. For Prince Edward Island, the bottom line was that, as of late summer 1968, the federal government practically hit the reset button on CDP negotiations. In early September 1968, the federal side provided PEI with a response to the proposal that the province had submitted in May. It had been sent forward to cabinet by Maurice Sauvé and left to await the outcome of the federal election. Campbell and Gallagher considered the new tone and revised details of the federal approach to be such a departure from their previous dialogue that they informed their federal counterparts that Prince Edward Island was withdrawing from the entire process. This led to a hectic series of talks in Ottawa in mid-September. Even after the draft plan was resuscitated and put back on the negotiating table, there were struggles over bureaucratic language and notably over the amount of money the federal government was prepared to commit. On October 9, 1968, Premier Campbell sent a telegram to Deputy Minister Tom Kent to say, "It now seems clear that a major rewriting job is needed on the program guide. In general, we feel the need to minimize the emphasis on the Economic Improvement Corporation and the plan, and to maximize the role of individual participation, decision-making, choices, etc." Premier Campbell's telegram cited specific examples of bureaucratic jargon and proposed that the parties should substitute "a language which will warm the cockles of all island hearts and will inspire their efforts to renew, restore, and revitalize the island they so much love." Campbell followed up by sending Andy Wells to Ottawa to offer the service of his capable pen, with the minimum objective to get rid of all the uses of the word viable. As Wells would recall 35 years later, "That was the moment I hated most in all the development plan stuff. I went to Ottawa and spent 3 days at it, in one of those little offices next to Tom Kent. The end result was that they wouldn't accept one single change, not one. Boy, did that come back to haunt us." The sole change was a decision to call it the Prince Edward Island Development Plan. In popular terms, it remained the Comprehensive Development Plan, the CDP, or simply the Plan. The biggest challenge when it came to finalizing the CDP was to follow the money.
Between August 1968 and March 1969, there were 13 different versions of the plan, with cost sheets ranging from a high of $809 million over 15 years to a low of $392 million. In late January 1969, Campbell wrote a five-page memorandum to Jean Marchand protesting a cap on the federal government's financial commitment, which the province said had been arbitrarily applied some months ago. This led to a series of testy exchanges, including sharply worded telegrams between Campbell and Prime Minister Trudeau in early February 1969. These were followed with a more friendly conversation on the eve of a First Minister's Conference in Ottawa. This conversation provided the impetus for the final agreement, which was concluded on February 18, 1969. While the nominal amount of the federal contribution was not increased, these late-in-the-process altercations laid the groundwork for a mutually respectful relationship between the parties in the implementation of the CDP, including careful attention to boundaries between federal regional development dollars and resources from other federal programs. The 15-year plan was announced in early March as comprising $225 million in federal funding over the life of the CDP. The provincial contribution was announced as approximately $500 million.
Narrow historical window, divergent perspectives.
By the time the Prince Edward Island Plan was signed in March 1969, the federal government was already revising its approach to regional development. With the creation of the new Department of DRI, Marchand and Kent moved quickly to signal a preference for urban growth centres, or pôles de croissance, as the answer to economic development. In September 1969, Marchand told a meeting of community planners in St. John's, "The growth of the urban community is the key to the progress of the people of the region." The growth centre's perspective represented a major new orientation in federal regional development priorities, a long way from the rural roots of Arda and Fred. Moreover, it combined with the 1970 designation of the corridor from Montreal to Cornwall, Ontario, as eligible for regional development support. For Prince Edward Island, the window of opportunity to negotiate its comprehensive development plan had been open for only 3 years, from May 1966 to mid-1969. Beyond responding to the pressures or serendipity of timing, the larger challenge for the CDP was to reconcile divergent philosophical and jurisdictional mindsets of the federal and provincial governments. From the time of Confederation, the federal government had dealt with claims of regional difference and disparity. However, from the federal perspective, these tended to be either issue-specific, such as concerns about transportation, tariffs, or resource ownership, or crisis-driven, in response to crop failures, mine closures, natural disasters, or the Great Depression. The Diefenbaker government, inspired by Walter Gordon's 1957 Royal Commission, was the first to look upon regional development as national economic policy. While the Diefenbaker government's efforts were grand, they were project-specific, providing funding for dams, irrigation, or roads, and were inspired by an economic engineering focus on the more efficient use of resources. The consummate project was the Canada Land Inventory, a massive effort to map and enhance the economic utility of Canada's land and physical resources. By the time PEI's comprehensive development plan was being negotiated, the Canada Land Inventory work was reaching its crest, and development policy was evolving to include manpower as an integral part of the picture. By March 1969, the CDP was caught in the cross-currents of these streams of thought. The people with the pen, the ones whom Andy Wells and Alex Campbell were unable to persuade to adopt language which will warm the cockles of all island hearts, saw the Prince Edward Island plan as being aimed at the reallocation of land to its most profitable use in the case of agriculture, and in the case of fishery, they envisaged necessary gains in efficiency which would be achieved through major investments in improved wharf and other facilities concentrated in major fishing centres. For Alex Campbell and the provincial government, the development plan was about fueling a new takeoff for PEI's economy and society. Education was a major priority for the province, as was building capacity in the provincial public service. Both areas presented a challenge to the federal side, as these were subjects clearly within provincial jurisdiction and went well beyond the paradigm of more efficient resource exploitation. Prince Edward Island wasn't the first jurisdiction to offer a challenge when it came to incorporating education into a federal-provincial development plan. The Northeast New Brunswick plan, the first to be concluded under the FRED program, had almost $50 million out of a total $90 million devoted to education. Lynn Petschke recalls that when the plan was presented to the Federal Deputies Committee, Simon Reisman, who was then Deputy Minister of Industry, slammed the table and said, "God damn it, we just agreed that the federal government would stay out of education, but we can't do this without it." The New Brunswick plan went ahead, complete with the education funding. When it came to the PEI plan 2 years later, the federal side was still nervous about education. They were comfortable dealing with adult education and vocational training and with post-secondary funding. For primary and secondary education, where the lion's share of the resources were needed, the CDP more or less fudged the issue by making provision for an unrestricted development grant with $20.6 million in federal funding during phase one. As André Sommier would recall 45 years later, the PEI development plan was fraught with danger, notably because a major objective was to overhaul the educational system and transform the two colleges into a real university with federal funds. The educational component was a very difficult nut to crack for the feds and the province. From the provincial side, a significant portion of PEI's contribution came through multi-year spending on education, totaling almost $100 million over the first 5 years. The federal side accepted squeezing in provincial government organizational and staff development under plan management, and the federal government providing 60% of the total $21.5 million cost of what was termed implementation. Housing, which would become one of the most innovative and popular areas of CDP activity, was justified in the original plan documents in the language of resettlement. However, the province got its way on the details, which projected that assistance to urban housing will be concentrated in 20 to 25 communities, and further, because of the importance of the agricultural sector, it is imperative that farmers be offered the same opportunities and alternatives as others. The inherent dualities of regional development and the need to reconcile central versus regional outlooks were ultimately tested in the personality of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. In May 1968, shortly after becoming Prime Minister and on the eve of calling a federal election, Trudeau invited Alex Campbell, along with Premiers Joey Smallwood of Newfoundland and Louis Robichaud of New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia Liberal leader Gerald Regan, to dinner at 24 Sussex Drive. 2 days later, Trudeau announced plans to create a Minister for Atlantic Affairs, who would also be the advocate in Cabinet for regional development to strengthen national unity. Trudeau indicated that this minister might assume responsibility for underdeveloped areas elsewhere in Canada. He said that this was consistent with his general objective to reduce regional disparities throughout the country. Still, Trudeau could not resist his natural drive to centralize, noting the advantage of bringing the FRED and ARDA programs, as well as the Cape Breton Development Corporation and the Atlantic Development Board, under one roof. André Sommier characterizes Trudeau's 1968 campaign promise to launch a decisive attack on regional equality as famous last words. Sommier says that the PEI development plan was on a proportional basis the biggest of any of the plans and was, until Tom Kent and Jean Marchand took over the new Department of DRE, probably the largest development plan ever attempted.
Plan implementation.
The complexities of the federal-provincial relationship and constitutional jurisdiction, plus the CDP's joint funding arrangements, called for flexibility in the plan's implementation, as well as for learning from experience. The CDP provided for ongoing monitoring, negotiation, and federal-provincial diplomacy through a joint advisory board. What came to be known as the JAB was a recommendatory body co-chaired by Alex Campbell for the province and the Deputy Minister of Regional Development for the federal government. While a joint advisory board would be criticized by the opposition as a derogation of provincial sovereignty, it provided the PEI cabinet and senior officials with regular access to an array of top federal bureaucrats, including the deputy ministers of regional development, finance, agriculture, transport, fisheries, and others, who came well briefed to meetings that took place at least twice a year, generally on Prince Edward Island. Through the JAB, and because of ongoing joint management of the plan, PEI had privileged access to and continuing discussions with the federal bureaucracy. Moreover, the JAB meetings became regular occasions on which senior federal officials left Ottawa to deal with Prince Edward Island issues in context. It was not uncommon for the meetings to turn to discussion of concerns about how well other federal programs were working. While it had no formal decision-making power, the JAB was a deliberative body which worked with advanced planning documents and assessments, detailed minutes and agendas, and supporting bureaucrats. Even senior federal officials who were not formally part of the Joint Advisory Board were typically aware of Prince Edward Island policy positions and issues. Richard Higgins, who served as PEI's Deputy Minister of Development from 1971 to 73, cites the example of Thomas Shoyama, who served as Assistant Deputy Minister of Finance and later Deputy Minister of Finance during the CDP years. Higgins says that Shoyama saw Prince Edward Island as a little Saskatchewan. Shoyama was a Saskatchewan native and was a provincial public servant until the defeat of the NDP government in 1964 when he moved to Ottawa. Higgins says that when a PEI file got to finance and arrived on Shoyama's plate, he gave it his attention, his prodigious intelligence, and he always delivered. By the summer of 1968, Alex Campbell was having second thoughts about whether the development plan should be implemented through the Economic Improvement Corporation. Implementing and coordinating the plan would involve an intricate array of relationships. In Campbell's words, the development plan was to become the engine of change in the years to come. It would not have been seeming or appropriate to have a civil servant running the province while the premier attended funerals and performed the ceremonial roles. The development plan would touch on every aspect of public policy and involve all departments of government, with a variety of cost-sharing arrangements and complex federal-provincial terms and requirements. Federal officials preferred to deal with the EIC and keep the relationships at the bureaucratic level. The issue came to a crunch in the fall of 1968, with Campbell going to Ottawa to meet with Transport Minister Don Jameson, who was PEI's regional representative in the federal cabinet. They met late into the evening at the Chateau Laurier, with the result that Jameson became an advocate for Campbell's position that the levers and the reins should be left with the cabinet and with the premier. Campbell decided that the EIC should wind up business as a Crown corporation and be replaced by a new Department of Development, of which he would be minister. While he appreciated and admired what Del Gallagher and EIC had done to shape and negotiate the plan, he recognized that some bridges had been burned on PEI and in Ottawa. Campbell met with Gallagher to inform him that EIC would be wrapped up and offered him a senior position as economic advisor, which Gallagher declined. When Gallagher informed his EIC colleagues that he was leaving and that they would have opportunities to join the public service, a number of them offered to resign. Gallagher endeavored to dissuade them, saying, "It's going to be fine. It's what the premier needs to do." Richard Higgins, one of the planners who offered his resignation, would subsequently concede that Campbell was correct, saying, "That was part of Alex Campbell's genius." With the cooperation of Jean Marchand and Tom Kent, Campbell recruited Hector Horty, who had served as a coordinator on the federal side throughout the planning process, to serve as Deputy Minister of Development. Horty was surprised, as he expected Gallagher would get the job. In a 2005 interview, he said that he and Gallagher had a lot of respect for each other and that they both had a lot of respect for Alex Campbell. The two met over a bottle of Aquavit and agreed that Campbell's scenario was the correct one, with Gallagher telling Horty, "Old friend, it's got to be you." Del Gallagher's departure and the winding down of the EIC were not warmly welcomed by island stakeholders who had been involved in developing the plan. There were petitions circulated at community schools operated by the Rural Development Council. They called for the EIC's retention and protested against the dangers of political interference in the plan's implementation. A column in the Eastern Graphic, appearing under the pen name Observer, said that while not too many tears would be shed over Gallagher, the disappearance of the chief architect of the plan at this point in time sort of sends shivers through a lot of people. Campbell remained on good terms with Del Gallagher, including as a sometime consultant for the PEI government, and recognized that the comprehensive development plan would not have become a reality without him. Gallagher was feted at a farewell dinner organized by the Rural Development Council and an array of community organizations, including the Credit Union and the Federation of Agriculture. One speaker paraphrased the text of a plaque commemorating the 1864 Charlottetown Conference by saying, "History will record that he builded better than he knew."
Reins in hand.
At the March 7, 1969 signing ceremony for the Comprehensive Development Plan, held in Memorial Hall at the Confederation Center, Alex Campbell said, "Let us all work together to grasp the future to the best of our abilities, our energies, and our enthusiasms. 15 years hence, hopefully, we will have realized the marvelous opportunities we now face together. It will require a great deal of work and a great deal of patient endeavor. And there will be moments, I know, when perhaps we question whether or not our optimism is justified. However, we islanders have a remarkable ability to persevere, to fight, and to overcome our disadvantages." With the Comprehensive Development Plan and new federal dollars in hand, Alex Campbell was prepared to embark on a new phase of his premiership.